coming up.
Hey, boy, how you doing? Man, what's gotten into you? Jeez, you're pretty uppity for someone who eats bugs all day.
Can keeping pets be morally justified?
Does everyone's dog get to live its best life?
Not every pet needs as much care as a dog. You could get a hamster or a goldfish.
Not every pet needs as little as a dog. What about parrots or sugar gliders?
Don't some animals benefit from being kept as pets?
I wrote this poem for you. It's called Cat Math. 4 paws plus 1 tail plus 9 lives equals 1 special cat. 1 special cat minus 9 lives equals 1 sad little girl.
What does it mean to take good enough care of your cat or your dog?
Your mother and I have been thinking about giving the puppies away.
No!
Mainly your mother.
Pet ethics, coming up on Philosophy Talk. Do we really have the right to own our fellow creatures?
Are there some animals that should never be kept as pets?
Is it okay to declaw a cat or to clip a bird's wings?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy, and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about pet ethics. Is it okay to own an animal?
Oh, Josh, it's not just okay, it's a moral requirement. Everybody should have a dog.
Come on, Ray. I mean, if you really love dogs, I don't think you should be encouraging everybody to get one. I mean, look, a lot of people get a dog at Christmas and then they can't care for them properly, and that poor dog ends up at a shelter or stuck at home alone all day.
Well, okay, maybe those people should get a hermit crab or something. But everybody should have some sort of a pet.
Yeah, I don't even know about hermit crabs. I mean, they're wild animals, right? I mean, shouldn't they be allowed to swim free with the waves flowing through their claws?
It's not like their owners are hurting them as long as they get enough food and sunlight and, like, whatever hermit crabs need.
Okay, but even if you provide for their material needs, it just seems unfair to have total power over their lives. I mean, how can you own another living being?
Oh, Josh, what is freedom to a hermit crab? It just doesn't have the kind of brain that cares about that.
All right, I'll grant you that's probably true for hermit crabs, Ray, but other animals have more complicated needs. Like your beautiful dog, Blossom. Are you really giving her enough so she can live her best life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I feed her. I walk her. I take her to the vet. I call her my sweet cinnamon roll.
All right, okay, so you're doing the bare minimum.
No, I'm not done yet. I do enrichment training with her every day. I bring her to work. In fact, she is here right now. Hey, you want to say hi? Hey, Blossom. Blossom, speak.
Okay. All right, I take it back, Ray. You're clearly a great pet owner. But that sure sounds like a lot of work. I just wonder whether most people can manage to provide their pets with that same level of care.
Well, not every pet requires as much care as a dog. You could get a cat or a hamster or a goldfish.
Okay, but on the other side, not every pet requires as little care as a dog. What about people who keep monkeys and sugar gliders or even parrots for that matter?
What about parrots?
Well, if you want to give a parrot a proper parrot life, you have to let it fly.
Isn't there any kind of pet you think the average person can take care of properly?
Sure. A Tamagotchi pet. Or a Chia pet.
You know you have to water a Chia pet, right?
Fair enough. But I feel like even an absent-minded professor like myself could probably just about manage to do that.
Yeah, luckily not everyone's like you. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shireen Adel, to talk to happy pet owners about why they bring animals into their homes. She files this report.
When you think of pets, you might think of dogs or cats. Last year, when I decided I was ready for pets, I adopted 2 kittens, Moose and Dusty. They're really affectionate, they're easy to take care of, and they communicate to tell me when they're content or when they need something. But when I asked other people what kinds of pets they have, some of their answers surprised me.
I take care of 2 red-eared sliders. Those are aquatic turtles. Their names are Gamera and Skeletor. And they're both female.
I have a hairless guinea pig. Her name is Olive, which is short for olive oil can, because she looks like an aluminum tin can with her fat little wrinkles on her sides.
After having her for like 12 years at least, she was digging a hole to lay a clutch of eggs.
She's very food motivated, so if she ever sees you come into the room, she will be pretty actively verbose, chirping and making sounds.
We got our tree frog from a Home Depot tree, actually. So it was a total surprise when I found her. I love that she's not a cat or a dog, to be honest. It's just kind of a different kind of pet that we weren't even expecting.
According to the American Veterinary Medical Association, after cats and dogs, fish and birds are the most popular pets. Rabbits, ferrets, hamsters, and turtles also make the top 10. And it turns out reptiles are gaining popularity too.
Right now I have 2 cats and 2 dogs, as well as 2 reptiles.
Jesse Kilborn is a zookeeper in Tampa, Florida. She says that after she started working with reptiles, she really started to love them.
You don't really think about the personalities that go along with them. And they do each have these wonderful, unique, individual personalities that are so much fun.
She says even though they aren't like cats and dogs, one of her lizards is pretty social.
My bearded dragon absolutely loves tactile at this point. It loves to be pet.
But her other reptile, a Euromastix, or a spiny tail lizard, doesn't like a lot of human interaction.
So he's not a pet that I would encourage if you are wanting a lot of cuddle time or you want to be able to pick them up and pet them all the time. But he's so unique and he likes to run around on our floor and explore, and our Great Dane desperately wants to be best friends with him.
For Jesse, caring for a pet is about giving an animal the best life it can have. And that's especially important when you give an animal that's not domesticated a home. She got her lizard from a licensed rehabber after someone decided it wasn't a good pet for them. That kind of thing happens a lot.
People will get pet snakes from the pet store and think that they're super cool and look, I'm edgy, I have a snake and this is great, but they don't do their research and they don't realize that that snake is going to grow to be 9 feet long.
As a zookeeper, part of her job is to understand the environment that an animal needs to thrive when they're in human care.
We are constantly doing studies to make sure that the habitats that they are in are built to facilitate their needs, to go beyond their needs, to encourage natural behaviors for that specific species. Things are added in every single day to change that habitat so that it's not the same all the time. It's enriching, it's exciting.
Jesse says when people realize they can't take care of their exotic or specialty pet, they often release them into the wild. Not only is that bad for the animal's survival, but it can be a problem for the environment too. Many states have restrictions on which animals can be kept as pets, specifically based on whether they could become pests when introduced into the wild. In California, for example, it's illegal to own hedgehogs, gerbils, or ferrets, even though they're common pets elsewhere. So I asked Jesse, if it takes so much to keep wild animals in human care, shouldn't we just leave them alone?
My response to that would sort of be, what wild? Because we as humans keep growing and we keep taking over their environments.
For a lot of people, having pets is just fun. And if you know what you're doing, you might also be giving them their best shot at survival. But for me, when it comes to pets, I'll stick with my kittens.
I got cat class and I got cat style.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shireen Adil.
Thanks for that great report, Shireen. I love kittens too. They're, you know, tree frogs. That sound like fun too. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about pet ethics.
We're joined now by Gary Varner, who's a professor of philosophy at Texas A&M University and the author of Personhood, Ethics, and Animal Cognition. Gary, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad for being here. I really enjoy the program.
So Gary, what first got you started on pet ethics? Do you, I don't know, keep large cats in your backyard?
Oh, no. I had various pets as a kid, like a lizard and a hamster and so on, who hamsters were just mentioned. But what really has gotten me most interested in pets is, as an adult, most of my adult life, I've kept cats as pets. And then in 2011, I adopted a pregnant feral cat from a nearby colony.
Wow.
By literally trapping her in my house before she gave birth. And living with her the last 9 years has been very challenging, but also very rewarding, more rewarding than any other relationship I've had with a cat.
So philosophically speaking, how should people describe their relationship to their pets? Do you think they're like friends or like children or what?
Well, I think we can have substantially different kinds of relationships with pets. For instance, some of the pets you guys just mentioned are not really suited, I think, to becoming true companions. So like the fish that was mentioned, in the way that dogs and cats are very well suited to becoming companions because they've been, you know, either fully domesticated or partially. And then I like to use the term domesticated partner to refer to pets who work in fairly sophisticated ways with their humans and ways that exercise the pet's mental and physical abilities in healthy ways. So I think you can have a much better, more nuanced and two-way relationship with a cat than with a frog. But then think about a dog who is a working dog or runs agility courses. In contrast to a lap cat, you have a much more sophisticated relationship with them.
Is that how you describe your relationship with your feral cat? I mean, would you think of that as a companionship relationship or what?
I would say it's primarily a companionship relationship, but cats are, you know, they have a bad rap that is not deserved as not being trainable. But I think that anybody can work with cats training wise in ways that will improve the quality of their relationship from both ends. So I've taught Maggie, my feral cat, to stop doing something or not do something when I say no, to come on command, and to go into a carrier to get her dinners. And that kind of basic training with cats is, I describe it as kind of, I don't know, cultivating to the extent practicable a domesticated partnership with her. But cats are, I think, a primary example of people who are really suited to being companion animals.
So I'm curious about training. So I've often heard people say, when I train my dog, well, you shouldn't boss your dog around. Do you think that training is bossing around, or is there a better way to think of it?
I'm not an expert on training, but my sense from what I've read and heard and doing it myself is you don't have to take the boss around approach, certainly not with a cat. They're not going to do things if they don't want to. And so you need to take the approach of making it attractive to the cat to do what you want to. Dogs are a little more complicated case, I think, because in evolutionary terms, they thrive like wolves in a hierarchical structure, a pack structure. And it's often said that human pet keepers, when they keep dogs, become and need to become the dominant animal in the pack who, you know, leads the pack around, as it were. But that doesn't mean, I forget what you said a second ago, you know, not forcing them to do things, but being in one sense the boss, but maybe not bossy.
Yeah, I want to ask about dominance, actually, because it seems like a lot of the sort of stuff about like alpha pack structure with wolves was based on sort of faulty research. And so I guess I want to register a comment about dominance that I'm not quite sure that's the way I think about my relationship with my dog. But it seems weird to dominate a cat, too.
Yeah, well, how about leader instead of dominance? Mm-hmm. Does that sound, you know, kinder and friendlier?
Yeah, that makes more sense.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about pet ethics with Gary Varner from Texas A&M University.
Are pets our friends or our property? What does it mean to take good enough care of your cat or your dog? And is it ever okay to keep wild animals in your home?
Lions and tigers and bears as pets? When Philosophy Talk continues. That's all he'll ever be. He's a dog, but he's all right with me. Is your dog your partner, your property, or something in between? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about pet ethics with Gary Varner from Texas A&M University, the author of Personhood, Ethics, and Animal Cognition.
We're still sheltering in place as we pre-record this episode, so we aren't able to take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or tweet us. Our handle is @PhilTalkRadio.
So Gary, what, if anything, gives us the right to keep other animals in our homes and make decisions about how every aspect of their lives is going to go?
Well, there's really widespread agreement about a couple of basic kind of foundational points among the philosophers who have written about pets. One is that you acquire specific obligations, like of being a pet keeper, by things that you do. This is a familiar notion in our common sense morality that, you know, signing a contract or saying I do creates special obligations between you and another individual. And there's general agreement that, it, like in the paradigm sort of case where I trapped my feral cat in my house, in doing so, I became responsible for its well-being. And the corollary point in terms of the substance of your obligations and what the minimal criterion for it being okay for you to keep them is that you provide for their physical and psychological needs and ensure that they have at least, well, one philosopher puts it, a comparatively good life to what they would have had if you hadn't taken them on as a pet.
Right. So that raises questions for me about whether it's okay not just to adopt a pet from a shelter, but sort of create new, like, domesticated animals. So in that case, like, take somebody who breeds dogs, there's not really a life that the dog would have had if they hadn't been created. So, like, how do we think about the ethics of creating new domestic animals?
Breeding, then, bringing new ones into existence. Yeah, I haven't thought carefully as a philosopher about identity problems, but those are, you know, identity problems are widespread with human reproduction and other sorts of cases, future generations and so on. And I don't have a particular line on that. I will say that I've always thought that people should adopt from shelters, for instance, or, you know, stray or feral animals, rather than to have purpose-bred animals. And the basic rationale there in my thought is that there are already enough cats and dogs, for instance, around who don't have an owner, that it doesn't make sense to breed more for the purpose of ownership when there are all of these diverse animals available already.
Right. Another question I wonder about sometimes is the idea of, like, keeping an animal in a kind of nuclear family arrangement, which is what I do with my dog, really. But in some places, you have sort of just populations of feral cats and dogs who are more part of the community, and that seems more egalitarian. So there's a sort of small question about, like, what would this individual have been doing if I had not taken this individual into my home? But there's also, like, what are animals in society doing that they might not have been doing if we organized society differently? Like, how should I think about those considerations?
Well, feral cats, I have no apologies for trapping a feral cat in my house, given that I socialized her kittens, adopted them out to good homes, and she, by all lights now, leads a perfectly satisfying life in my house with me. Because of what life would be like for a feral cat, and, you know, she already existed, there are no identity problems there. If I had not trapped her in my house before she gave birth, there would be six feral cats in the neighborhood that aren't there now. And given that the life of a feral cat, I don't think is as good as the life of a well-kept companion animal, then I think that I've improved their situation. And I also think, in the case of dogs, I think it's very clear that living with human beings, that kind of living in human society, integrated into it instead of in the wild, is natural to them. They're naturally environment for the kind of selection that produced the modern dog, presumably as a, you know, a relative of the wolf. And when it comes to cats, they're not as thoroughly domesticated, as naturally integrated into human society as dogs, but the cats have occupied the same communities as humans for thousands of years, going back at least 3,700 years, I believe. So it seems to me that the question of what's natural for a cat or a dog is significantly different than the question of what's natural for a wild animal that's whose ancestors haven't gone through the process of domestication.
That's a really good point. And I love your general rule of thumb that if you're giving the animal at least as good a life, maybe a better life than it would have in the wild, then, you know, you're on morally strong ground. And so that leads me to a more philosophical question about where do you think we clearly we have these intuitions that we have moral responsibility towards pets? Is it, you know, are you with a rationalist? It's because animals have reason just like us. Are you with a sentimentalist? Animals have feelings and, you know, they can suffer just like us. Are you with Kant that, you know, it's ultimately, if we mistreat animals, we're likely to be bad people in other respects too? Where do you think our I think correct moral intuitions come from, that we have obligations towards our pets?
Well, I think in utilitarian terms, ultimately, but I'm a two-level utilitarian, meaning I think there are good utilitarian reasons for not thinking like explicitly like a utilitarian most of the time. So I go more the, as you characterized it, sentimentalist route. I think that from that perspective, from a utilitarian perspective, any entity that is sentient, that has positively or negatively valenced psychological states, counts morally speaking. And so I think the proper way to think about how basing our relationships is they're sentient beings. And in the case of cats and dogs, they're sentient beings who have cohabited with us for a long time.
So the idea is we should seek the greatest good for the greatest number, but some of those number are animals like cats and dogs.
One tail, one vote.
So what's this two-level thing? Like, where does that come in?
Well, let me give you an example that I can relate to pets specifically. Think about, I characterize the utilitarian perspective, the principle of utility, as saying, arrange things so that aggregate happiness is maximized. I don't say do what will maximize aggregate happiness in this or that situation. Arrange things. Because if you walked around consciously calculating like a utilitarian all the time, you wouldn't make a very good friend or lover for your fellow human beings. And I think analogously, people should, at what in two-level utilitarianism I call the intuitive level, people should love their animals, not for the sake of maximizing aggregate happiness or what benefits the humans get, but the same way that we think in a healthy human relationship, you love the individual for themselves.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about pet ethics with Gary Varner from Texas A&M University. And Gary, you know, you were just saying we should love our animals. And I agree with you, but we got a really interesting email from Corey in San Francisco, who says, who quotes Les McCann from a song called Compared to What? And here's the quote: tired old ladies kissing dogs. I hate the human love of that stinking mutt. I can't use it. Trying to make it real compared to what? And Corey says, my sentiments exactly. So Corey doesn't seem to share our sense that we can and should love pets. What do you say to that, Gary?
I think Corey shouldn't own dogs.
So you just think it's kind of a case by case thing. Some of us are, you know, temperamentally disposed to have pets and be benefited by them and benefit them, but other people not.
I don't know if temperamentally in the sense of congenitally, but the circumstances of your life can, you know, lead you to not like dogs because of previous experiences or something. There's the old question, are you a cat person or a dog person? And then also Ray said earlier something to the effect, not entirely seriously perhaps, that everybody should own a dog. Clearly, people who are in a career that takes so much time away from the home that they can't adequately exercise the dog mentally and physically probably shouldn't have a dog. But he did add, of course, that there are other options. And he got down to goldfish, I think, in addition to cats as another option that's less labor intensive, less demanding in the relationship with a human.
Yeah, I didn't mean that entirely seriously, although I do wonder. So do I have a responsibility to cultivate my capacity for relationships with like others, including pets? So if you just had a hermit who was happy without friends, without pets, and who could had the ability to take care of a pet and love the pet, but just decided not to, would there be anything wrong with that? Like, it doesn't seem like the greatest good for the greatest number if they're not exercising their capacities.
Well, I think a basic part of the justification for ownership of pets is that it makes the lives better, or at least can make the lives better, of both the human pet owner and the animal. And there's various kinds of evidence that keeping pets is good for human beings. We get various benefits out of it. But as I said a second ago, there can be particularities of a person's life that make it not so appropriate for them to have a dog, for instance, as a pet, or maybe even a cat. But I also think in terms of you asking about, well, a hermit who sounds like someone who shuns relationships with humans. I do, in my work, argue that pet owners should definitely try to keep companion animals rather than what I call mere pets, like a goldfish or a frog or something, where you can't really have any companionship relationship. But my rationale is that the benefits we get and the animal companions get is better on both sides of the deal in that case than with a mere pet like a goldfish or a frog. And I also argue on the cultivating relationships tangent, I argue that people should, to the extent practicable, as I said a little while ago, cultivate domesticated partnerships through training with their animals. Not all animals, maybe the goldfish or the frog, are suitable to that. But if you're going to have a pet, you should cultivate your relationship with it. But I wouldn't go so far as to say everybody, including this hypothetical hermit, should keep pets.
Right. But I think you've made a really strong case for it being good for a lot of people and good for the animals in the cases where those people are taking care of the animal lovingly and responsibly. I'm also a little bit curious about cases where it doesn't go as well. So, you know, I come from Britain, and there's kind of a cliche there that many Brits like their dogs better than they like other people. And, you know, I wonder about cases where someone might be very good to their pet. And perhaps is it possible that as a consequence, they have maybe less love to go around? I don't know. And certainly there are some, obviously there are tragic cases of people abusing their pets. And there are also cases of people, you know, using their pets to bad ends. I mean, thinking about, you know, there was a case in San Francisco in 2001 of someone who was killed by a pit bull, which was owned by a neo-Nazi, who'd clearly been mistreating this dog and, you know, training it up to be rather vicious. So what should we say about cases like those where things really aren't going well at all?
Well, there have been various studies examining the connection between abuse of animals, including pets, and abuse of other people. I can't say that I know that literature well, and I don't, but my impression is that it's not a foregone conclusion or an established conclusion empirically that people who mistreat animals are more likely to mistreat humans. And the other way around, the Brit who loves their dog more than they like other people, that might just be a lucky dog because of how much attention it's going to get. These are complicated issues, and I think we need to, as a society, debate how we should best regulate, with the goal of maximizing aggregate happiness, including that of the non-human animals in our society, how we can most effectively regulate pet keeping. That would include, I think, banning entirely pet ownership of certain wild animals, like big cats, for instance.
Yeah.
But communities might make different decisions about beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, I think about Kant's line, you know, he who is cruel to animals becomes hard also in his dealings with men. And I read a stat, I don't know how much to trust it, but that 43% of mass killers that they were able to get data on had a history of abusing animals in their youth.
Right, that's one of those kinds of studies that I'm referring to.
But tell me more about big cats. You know, I hate to refer to a notorious documentary that came out this year, but that raised a really intriguing moral question. It involved people who owned big cats, endangered species, and they clearly were not treating those animals nearly well enough. But on the other hand, the argument on the other side was, well, we're keeping the numbers up of these endangered populations. Is there a debate there, or are things clearly just going wrong in that case?
Well, there's certainly a debate about the legitimacy of zoos, for instance, sort of like the professional big cat keepers, and the degree to which those programs are, such breeding programs, are really contributing to preserving the species, at least ultimately in the wild. Because habitat modification is one of the biggest obstacles to maintaining species in the wild, especially big predators, big carnivores, usually have especially large ranges. But in terms of keeping them as pets, there are two things about big cats that I would emphasize from a policy perspective. And I'm not talking here about zoos. I'm talking about people, you know, in private homes, keeping big cats pose potentially a serious danger to their neighbors. And also keeping a big cat in ways that really fulfill its physical and psychological needs is a big task. And not everybody's up to that. Now, that lattermost point, of course, could be made with regard to relatively undangerous animals, like certain kinds of lizards, for instance, that the needs of the species are pretty complex and you really need to know what you're doing, but they don't pose such a problem if they get loose.
So I want to ask actually about zoos and animal sanctuaries. Like, is that a way of keeping like sort of social collective pets? Is that a different thing? It does seem like a lot of zoos and animal sanctuaries keep animals partly for sort of the pleasure of humans.
Well, the big cat sanctuary that I visited some years ago, the people there, the keepers, I would describe it as had a pet relationship, a bit of a domesticated partnership relationship with the cats, because they just fit all the criteria in terms of affection towards the animal, and the animal's needs depend on them. These are some of the basic features of what it means to really be a pet. But the keepers really felt affection for those animals too. So it seems to me that conceptually, those animals do count as pets. And that's true in zoos often, I think too, where the people responsible for them have that kind of attitude towards them. So I think they count as pets, but conceptually, but as a society, we want to think carefully about whether or not we want to encourage and which people we want to encourage to keep those kinds of animals. And the overarching rationale in the case of big cats, for instance, would presumably relate in terms of my judgment about their situation, would relate to preserving biodiversity, but getting the rubber to meet the road in terms of the animals, the species' continued existence in the wild, is a further sort of gap between having zoos. That's one of the debate questions people always raise is, well, you're maintaining genetic diversity, but it's in here, it's not out there.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about pet ethics with Gary Varner from Texas A&M University, author of Personhood, Ethics, and Animal Cognition.
Should some people be barred from owning pets? Is a permit really enough to justify keeping an exotic animal? Is it okay to breed dogs with those weird pushed-in faces?
Bulldogs, boxers, and Boston Terriers. When Philosophy Talk continues. Love cats. I adore them. But should I own them? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Gary Varner from Texas A&M University, and we're thinking about the ethics of pet ownership.
So Gary, we're going to make you czar of pet ownership nationwide with full power to change anything you want. That's something we like to do around here. What's your first move as czar of pets?
Well, let me mention one that's related to the situation with English bulldogs that Ray just alluded to a second ago with the brachiocephalic heads, for instance. I think there should be really significant changes in the ways that we think about what makes a good breed of dog. And rather than thinking about a good breed of dog looking like some ancestral archetype, as various breeds maintained by the AKC, the American Kennel Club, and similar associations in other countries. That's what they're trying to do, is make a dog that has a certain look about it. And I think that instead, if I could wave a philosophical wand and make this true overnight, I would create a line of what you might call certified companion bred dogs, which would consist of the initial generation being animals that score well simultaneously on robust health across a lifetime. So they're genetically robust, congenitally tend towards robust physical health, that are also trainable and low on aggression. And then each generation in the development of the breed, you would only breed the offspring who score the highest on those measures simultaneously. And as the famous Russian experiment with silver foxes indicated, they were able to turn wild foxes into tame animals that are now sold as pets in as little as about 10 generations. So which all with already domesticated dogs, in a few generations, we could create a breed that would be very diverse in its appearance. But anybody who adopted a certified companion bred dog would know that that's an animal that's likely to live a very healthy life, be very susceptible for training, and also be low aggression and just be a great domesticated partner.
Do you think that there is like enough uniformity in the needs of different people who want dogs? Like, I guess I'm thinking like somebody wants a couch potato dog versus somebody who wants an agility dog. Like, should those be separate breeds?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Within restrictions, I personally would approve of that. You never know. In fact, you could under this heading of certified companion bred dog, breed, because I was saying, you know, start from a wide variety of dogs who score not on the basis of how they look, but how they score on these kinds of tests. And it's not inconceivable to me that some, you know, larger breeds that tend to be less active as we know them today could have a part in such a program and produce like a sublineage that were larger, less active dogs that were less work to take care of.
Oh, neat.
But if I could add one related point, and this does relate to the faces of English bulldogs, it concerns me that people still think of pets as replaceable in the sense that I know people who, when they have a dog of a certain breed and the dog dies, they immediately get another dog of the same breed, as if what they're thinking is that they're replacing the previous dog with the new one. And it's a real replacement because it's the same breed, it looks the same, maybe it has some of the same habits. But if we have really loving relationships with our pets, I think we get more out of the relationship and probably the pets too. So in loving relationships with other humans, we don't think if your spouse dies that I'm going to go out and find me another spouse who looks like they did. We think I'm going to meet somebody who might look completely different, have different personality characteristics, but I'll learn to love, we'll develop a loving relationship too that's not based on something as superficial as the shape of your skull, as in the case of English bulldogs.
This also makes me sort of wonder about sort of issues relating to like the end of your pet's life. So one thing that a lot of people do at the end of their pet's life is euthanize them, which seems like a really strange thing to do to a creature you love, but it also seems strange to like just watch the creature you love suffer. Do you have thoughts about how to handle that transition?
Well, I happen to think in the case of humans that there are times when you should euthanize, including actively euthanize someone under, you know, some pre-specified conditions. And I think that being opposed to ending a life that's on a bad downward trajectory is a bad thing, either in the case of humans we love or in case of the animals we love. And with my previous generation of cats, I did in the end have each of them euthanized, but it was when their lives really did not promise to go well from then on out. I don't think that's a sign of lack of love. I hope that people will love me enough to let me depart sentient existence when things look as bad as they may look someday for various people.
I agree with what you're saying, and I to this day I'm marked by the loss of my wonderful cat, and absolutely euthanasia felt like the right thing to do. Very painful, but the right thing to do, and also the prolongation of her life felt like the right thing to do. But I want to ask you a devil's advocate question about that, because like many people, I spent quite a bit of money on prolonging my cat's life, and somebody might say, not me, but somebody might say, I could have given that money to charity. I could have kept a human being alive, perhaps, with that money. What's the argument for doing what I did, which is spending a lot of money to keep my cat alive for a little bit longer?
Yeah, I spent a lot of money keeping one of my cats that I was referring to a second ago alive a lot longer. If you think from the perspective of a two-level utilitarian, there are some kind of paradoxical results. And one of them that I believe in is that everybody in our society should have simultaneously the intuition that money is no object for the human being I love, and analogously with an animal who's really important to me. But at the same time, when it comes to setting public policy, we should also have the intuition or the judgment that we have to make choices as a society about where resources are best spent. And that's going to inevitably mean you don't spend as much as possible on every single individual. And human families who face the decision about whether to prolong the life of an animal or a human member of the family meet a similar sort of pair of contrasting, pulling in different directions judgments, the intuitive judgment that, no, we love our brother, our sister, our mother, our father, and no amount of money is too much to spend. But there's that reality call standing in the background of, you don't want to bankrupt the family for the sake of a few extra years of low quality life. So that's a judgment, that's a trade-off that we face in not just with regard to pets, but also humans.
So here's another place where what utilitarianism tells me seems a little bit different from what I would want to do. When I'm deciding which pet to adopt, one way to do it is to think, what is the most efficient way to choose an animal that my adopting them will maximize sort of happiness for everybody? And another way to do it is to go to the shelter and see which animal do I like which one speaks to me. And it seems like utilitarianism would leave me no room to ask, well, what animal do I feel a specific attachment to? Is it okay for me to just choose an animal based on like who I feel an attachment to rather than who I sort of anticipate would bring me the greatest utility over the course of my life and who I anticipate I would give the greatest utility to?
Yeah, well, in this context, let me remind you of what I said earlier about, well, if you're somebody who walks around thinking, calculating in utilitarian terms about whether or not, you know, whom to love, another human being, or about whether to keep the promise to your spouse, you know, to meet at the movie theater or whatever, you're not going to be maximizing aggregate happiness as effectively as you would if you internalized an intuitive response of, well, I don't break promises, period, even though we all acknowledge that there can be extreme conditions where you need to get over that intuition and act accordingly. And similarly, when it comes to adopting a pet animal, I 100% adopted my feral cat, not through a utility calculation, but because when I first saw her in my backyard, I remember to this day, out there, she wouldn't come near me for a long, 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 long time after that. But what I saw was not just a pretty cat, but I saw a nice cat, despite the fact that she's feral and I knew it. And seeing a nice cat basically means the same thing you were describing a second ago of that animal just spoke to me somehow. And that's an analog of what we do with our fellow human beings in terms of friendship and loving relationships and so on. And I don't think we should apologize for conditioning ourselves to think that way, even though according to a two-level utilitarian, it's, if you're thinking in terms of public policy or the laws for your community about pet ownership, then you need to take a very different perspective, an more explicitly utilitarian one. But I argue in my work that any version of utilitarianism that doesn't allow for these intuitive responses that we can condition ourselves into that aren't explicitly utilitarian and maybe don't maximize aggregate happiness in this or that various situations, we live a better life and we actually maximize happiness if we arrange things that way rather than arranging so that we all walk around doing utility calculations all the time.
I like the way that your theory leaves room for things that maybe a more traditional kind of utilitarianism would just leave out. I'm wondering if it also has a place for sort of the value of freedom and if animals can have freedom that's valuable. So one thing about a stray cat is that even if their life might be sort of less nice on a day-to-day level, they can sort of decide when they come and when they go and what they get to do. And it seems like a cat that lives in your house that you sort of maybe keep shut indoors all the time doesn't get that same freedom. Is that a value that animals can have?
I'm not sure what I want to say about that other than to point out that, well, in the field of animal science, which studies production animal agriculture, there are some really clearly drawn lines along which people differ with regard to what constitutes the well-being of an animal. One is based on, well, can it exhibit its natural repertoire of behaviors? And that one, if you stick just to that narrow line, doesn't take in feelings, the subjective feelings of the animal. Another line, which for a long time was a small minority among animal scientists, says, no, animal well-being is all about feelings. And I don't know where to come down there other than to say that my commitment to utilitarian feels plausible to me, because I think what ultimately matters are the experiences of sentient animals. And I don't know what to say about freedom per se, other than in the spirit of utilitarianism, I would look at the life of an animal who had that freedom, however you described it a second ago, to come and go as they please, for instance, or other conception of freedom, and then compare the subjective life of an animal who's a house cat and, you know, doesn't get to do that. But I'm not sure where to come down on freedom per se as a value. It, one way or another, I'm committed to thinking it has to get cashed out in terms of the experiences of the animal or the human.
Well, Gary, you've been a fantastic companion today, and it's been super illuminating. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Gary Varner, professor of philosophy at Texas A&M University and author of Personhood, Ethics, and Animal Cognition. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Yeah, I really like a lot of the changes that Gary is advocating for in the way that we think about dogs as a society, not just that we need to meet their basic needs, but that we should be helping them to flourish, and we should be breeding dogs that will flourish and adopting them from animal shelters rather than producing a lot of surplus ones.
Totally agree. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog. Now, faster than a rescue greyhound, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. When I was a kid, the only support animal was a seeing-eyed dog, which was always a German Shepherd. Dogs with Mounties were Huskies. Dogs in the Alps are always St. Bernards. Dogs with Timmy were Lassies. And a puppy in a teacup had to be a Chihuahua. Well, times have changed. Support animals now include everything from parrots to pythons. Some poor emotional wrecks even tried to lug Shetland ponies onto airplanes and use border collies to herd toddlers. The line between pets and support animals, and domestic partners as far as that goes, is erased more every day. Violating written and unwritten rules of behavior can get you canceled and your pet rehomed to a loving forever home, or if your pet is old, sick, or boring, lovingly put down. Just like grandma, if this coronavirus thing goes on much longer, we get support from every kind of pooch, from authenticated dog show winner to the mutt. Even from cats now, which we didn't used to take seriously unless they were purebred, so they ran around chasing birds and quickly succumbed to weird cat diseases, cars, or coyotes. This is before the invention of kitty litter, which changed everything. Today, dogs and cats share the pet throne, as measured by the internet. Some animal activists reject the word pet, find the pet and master relationship creepy. It's all part of some neo-Marxist dialectical paradigm being pondered by a PhD candidate even as I speak, his fuzzy cat Trotsky curled up in his lap. It's a fraught subject, is all I'm saying, akin to racism. It's why we don't see rampaging Zulus or Apaches in movies anymore. As enemies, they're replaced by aliens, terrorist cults, and robots. And animals as pure entertainment are frowned upon. Bullfights, rodeos. We don't even have circuses because the elephants made us sad. And what's the point of a circus without elephants? We're iconoclasting up a storm, knocking down statues of Confederates, and even George Washington, cancel-culturing men we once admired, shunning women who were way too Karen, willing to throw the very concept of man and woman off the bus or under the bus, thrown on the dustbin of history with a horse and buggy, dial phones, and Marxism itself, which ironically gave us the dustbin of history in the first place. But we still have pets. We now live in the attention economy, and the coin of that realm is emojis. The cuter they get, the more we click on them. Exercise them, dote on them, feed them right, hug them, sleep with them. With pets, we don't even fight like cats and dogs. We lie down with them. Thanks to improved pet care, we don't even get up with fleas. Cats and dogs are saving us. They offer no arguments, just whining and the occasional growl. In return, we're probably saving them from extinction, at least until they stop being adorable. Sometimes our pets make a statement. We have little dog people, big dog people, French bulldogs, little fierce yappers. We get big orange boy cat people, Siamese people, big fluffy cat people, hairless cat people. We get pit bulls. That scares the neighbors, unless they have pit bulls, in which case, next stop, Judge Judy. It's a Darwinian smorgasbord. Filter through eugenics and half-remembered Disney movies. And now we have llamas, scorpions, tropical fish, lizards. Some prepper survivalists raise their own tilapia and their own fish farms. We could expand that to goldfish, guppies, and salamanders. Cows and chickens have been viewed with alarm by vegans and animal rights people, and merely people who believe in varying our diet make them pets, along with ducks and goats. Zebras and tigers and elephants could use a home away from the circus, the zoo, far from the slings and arrows and traps of poachers. We've already seen what happens to polar bears. Make them all pets. And so many arguments go away. The peaceful kingdom is the way to go. We become our own ark. Expand our homes to include enormous beasts of burden. Also whales, as well as spider monkeys, bats, and hippos. Cats will keep down the mice. Dogs will keep the sheep herded. And we'll have eggs till the cows come home, which is forever, because the cows are already home. Win-win. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Honey, you won't believe it. Toonses can drive a car.
Toonses are cats?
Yeah, come on, I'll show you.